I'm assuming that all these bulbs I have are probably the same thing. I bought different brands. Curious to see which ones are better. But it's just a regular light bulb. Duplicates a 40 watt light, and I think they're brighter than that. So that's why I buy them. They really, as far as I'm concerned, they duplicate a 60 watt light. So it's one of those. It's not a just a regular 110 Edison screw light bulb. Back to you.
In a case of the light-emitting diode type lights, many of them claim a lifetime of ridiculous numbers of thousands of hours, tens of thousands of hours. And in many cases, the power supply fails long before the light itself fails. On top of that, in the case of putting a light in the kitchen, your fixture may have been a recessed lighting fixture in the ceiling, and some of those have very little airflow around them. So the reliability and life of the power supply of a light-emitting diode flashlight is highly dependent on whether or not there's enough airflow around it. So that could have been an aggravating factor. Do you think you got the right number of hours of service out of the pole? And do you believe the way you mounted it in your kitchen, did it have enough airflow around it to keep it cool? WS2N, KQRIW.
Yeah, I would say probably 2.5 years, and I use it a lot, but they say if you leave it on 24/7, I think you're supposed to get 6 or 7 years out of it, and if you use it intermittently, it's supposed to go, 20 years, 21 years, so I use it years, I would think. I think I wound up with about 2.5. It's not recessed. It's a regular spotlight type of thing, a reveal type. So it's external to the ceiling. But yeah, it is. It's at a high point. My ceiling is like a cathedral type of ceiling. So it's at a high point. So it does get hot up there. And when I saw it fail, I was watching it when it failed. Started blinking real fast. Shut it off, turn it back on again, blinking real fast. It never came back to life, so heat definitely gets to it. Now, there's this spotlight arrangement that it's in. It has a bunch of holes in the metal itself, for any heat to escape. It lets heat escape, so it's not too bad. But, heat and electronics don't get along. Back to you there.
You probably already replaced it, Paul. What is the going number of dollars of cost of these 40 watt, 60 watt solid state lights these days? What's your approximate cost? Go ahead.
Oh, it comes out like $2.50 or something in Walmart now. It's so cheap. You buy two of them, it's like $5, $4.99 or something. It's just dropped tremendously over the years. And when I bought this one, it was probably about $6. This one, I think I remember, came out of Ace Hardware. And I think it was on sale for $5.99. Feit. I'm not sure how that's pronounced, but that's the brand. Back to you.
They certainly have come down in price. The solid state bulbs, 8 or so years ago, were numbers in the $20 category. So, two and a fraction dollars nowadays. Very nice. So, thank you for that report. Now, let's see what Mr. Joe has to say. What kind of a challenging question you're going to give us tonight, Joe? Are you going to go easy with us, or are you going to go give us a tough time? I'm having some fun with him. W-H-Y-Y-Y. K-2-R-I-W in the tech net.
Okay, Dick, I'm going to ask you a question. You can determine yourself whether you think it's an easy one or a hard one. Here goes. Can you use a grid dip oscillator to verify and check the resonance of different elements on a multi-element beam, whether they are grounded to the boom or floating off the boom? Back to you.
Yeah, I say you definitely can, Joe. If you hold, say for instance you're testing a HF frequency, and if you hold the resonator is usually wrapped around a plastic tube, and if you hold the resonator near the base of the element, in other words, very close to where the element hits the boom, or goes near the boom, and if you're holding the axis of the grid tip oscillator coil at right angles to the boom, but close to that element, you can measure the resonant frequency of that element. Now, you are going to get a little bit of an error on that. In other words, if that element on, let's say, 20 meters was supposed to be, because it's a director and it's supposed to be tuned high, maybe it's supposed to be tuned to 14.5 megahertz. If that element was being measured all by itself. Obvious, by the way, a Yagi works. The elements are electronically coupled to each other by way of what goes on in free space. So if you are measuring director number one, because there is a driven element to the left and another director number two to the right, they are going to make some interaction. In other words, if the resonant element really is at 14.5, you're going to measure, I wish I could know which way you're going to measure. Is it high or low? But it's not going to be ridiculously high. If it's supposed to be 14.5, you're going to measure either 14.7 or 14.3, you know, numbers like that. So you'll tell that the element is working and it's got reasonable Q. I mean, if you had telescoping pieces of tubing that made up that element, and if those telescoping pieces of tubing were made out of aluminum and...
Repeater, time out.
If they were made out of aluminum, let me wait for the beeps. They're made out of aluminum, and after 10 years of exposure between the inner and the outer telescoping piece of tubing that makes up the element, you've built up a tremendous amount of aluminum oxide. So now the element is thoroughly insulated, and therefore, instead of it resonant at 14.5 megacycles, it's resonant at 31 megacycles, so to speak, because it's not making any contact anymore. You'd be able to tell that right away. So, the grid tip meter, I say you can use it that way, Joe. But you're going to get a little bit of error because of the nearby elements. Now, in the case of a VHF antenna, where the resonator coming out of the grid tip oscillator is a U-shaped piece of large diameter metal, I guess it's a U-shaped device about an inch high. In that case, you're going to hold it near the element, near the base, so that the plane of the resonator of the grid tip oscillator and the axis of the element are parallel to each other. So that's how you're going to get the tightest coupling. But I say you can do that, Joe. There's a hell of a lot of things you can measure the resonant frequency with a grid tip oscillator. And the grid tip oscillator, in many cases, gives you a more and more accurate answer as you keep backing away and rocking the coil back and forth, rocking the resonant frequency back and forth. At the maximum distance where you can still detect a slight dip is where you get the greatest accuracy out of a grid dip oscillator. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet. Are you about to do that kind of a measurement, Joe?
No, because I don't own a grid dip oscillator, but maybe someday I will to be able to do something like that, but it's just a curiosity type of question. I know typically on a beam, a typical length of the driven element is something like 0.95 of a half wave from end to end, and so it's usually about 0.91 for the first director and so forth, and then like something like 1.05 for the reflector. So the reflector would actually tend to measure lower by about 5 or 6% compared to the driven element, and the first director should measure about 4 or 5% higher in frequency compared to the driven element. Would you say that's correct? And you should be able to see that and verify that with a grid tip oscillator.
Yes and no. What you said is true. However, if it was, let's say, a four-element Yagi, and you measure director number one, where you've now got director number two ahead of it and the driven element behind it, you've now got a lot of interaction going on, and therefore, although that element might be tuned 5% low in length, 5% high in frequency, because it's a director, and then you add the error factor because of two nearby elements, you're going to measure something that is a little bit off of where you think it should be. when you now measure director number two, the one out in front, it only has an element behind it, director number one. It doesn't have another director in front of it. There is no director number three. So the amount of offset, it's going to be a little bit crazy. So because of these other factors, when you measure exactly 5% high for directors and 5% low for a reflector and right on for a driven element, maybe not. Let me drop it. Another factor you should know about, and you can find out about this real fast by going to either one of the websites that support the TechNet, amateurradio.tv or LiveMarkTechNet.com. You'll find an article in there by K2RIW of how to get perfect tuning of the driven element of a Yagi or perfect tuning of a dipole. What you'll find out is that the exact length of the driven element is not magic. You may start off with the driven element. If you're designing your own Yagi, you may start off with it 95% of a half wavelength long as a starting position. But when you read that article, you'll discover that if you're willing to change the length of the driven element as a method of changing the resistive component of its impedance, and you're also going to be probably adding a top hat capacitor. In other words, you can readjust the length of the element to get the resistive component correct, and now you add a capacitive element to the end in order to get rid of the reactants. So, and there's interaction between those measurements. But what I'm getting at is, if you want to make the driven element perfect in impedance, very low in standing wave ratio, you're going to be adjusting the length of the driven element. There's nothing magic about the exact length of the driven element. Let me drop. A Yagi will give you full performance if the driven element resonates at your frequency, gives you a good standing wave ratio at your frequency, has the right kind of a balancing action by way of not launching any excess current going down the outside of the transmission line. So if it gives you a good impedance, if it's a dipole-like structure, then the whole rest of the Yagi will perform. Everything will start singing. So it only has to radiate in a dipole-like manner. Under some circumstances, that driven element could be longer than the reflector in order to get a good impedance match. Let me run that by again. A dipole in free space, half-wave dipole, has an impedance very close to 73 ohms resistor, and if it's the right length, it'll have no reactance. So it'll be a 73 ohm resistor with no reactance. Depending on your particular design of a Yagi, many Yagis, when the driven element is placed in the middle of that Yagi, because of the effect of the parasitic elements, reflector and directors, the dipole impedance might now be 20 ohms. That's a real number that happens with some real Yagi designs. 20, 25 ohms is now the new impedance of that dipole, which was 73 ohms in free space, but 20 some odd ohms when it's in the middle of that Yagi. If you're willing to now make the driven element longer, the 20 ohms that you see will go up to 50 ohms. You'll have a reactance left over. But then by retuning, by using gimmick capacitors and gimmick inductors and whatever, there's ways you can get rid of the reactance. There's some interaction when you do that. So the general length will adjust the resistive component with the reactive addition that you don't want, and there's another technique by which you eliminate the reactive component. So you can always make the driven element of Yagi a perfect impedance if you follow that tuning procedure that's in that article by K2RIW on those two websites. Because of that tuning procedure, you might very well find the driven element longer than the reflector. Let me drop.
WB2SWW.
How we recognized. Yeah, that factor really bugs the daylights out of people. Everything they know about Yagi theory tells them the reflector has to be longer than the driven element to act as a reflector. The reflector has to be longer than the half wavelength of length to act like a reflector. The director has to be shorter than the half wavelength in electrical length to act like a director. The driven element can be any length in the world that gives you a good impedance match, as long as it radiates in a dipole-like manner. So there are people who will Follow my procedure. They'll start lengthening the driven element in order to make the impedance better. Then measuring the standing wave ratio on a antenna analyzer, a standing wave ratio bridge, or a vector network analyzer, they see the impedance getting better and better as they make the driven element longer and longer. But pretty soon the driven element wants to be longer than the reflector, and because of their theory of how the Yagi works, they stop. They won't go any further. They won't go to the perfect tuning because they think the antenna is going to explode if they go there. I've talked to a number of hands who have run into that crazy characteristic. There's nothing magic about the particular length of the driven element. Just as long as it gives you the impedance you want when it's buried inside of that Yagi. Let's see what Howie's got to say. That'd be to HWW, K2RIW. Go ahead, Howie.
K2RIW. Happy Easter to everybody. Dick, I do have a problem with using a grid dip meter trying to do that. You're not going to get very accurate readings because your body is going to be affected. And even if you could get the grid dip meter using some kind of an insulated pole or something, the antenna itself is not going to be that high. You know, you're going to have to work 5 or 6 or 10 feet off the ground. You got to be at least a halfway block, I would assume, away from anything, because your body, the ground, is going to have an effect. So if you even came to residence or looked at the antenna, and then you put the antenna up on a tower or something, I would assume that you're going to get a total different effect. So I think the best way to do this is to use a, you know, an antenna analyzer or a site master. Using a grid dip meter may be a fun idea, but I think practically, just the fact that you're going to be near the antenna, you're going to cause a capacitance, even if you come near the ends of the reflector and of the driven element. K2RIW, WD2HWW. Bye.
Very fine, Howie. And now you and I here are in the middle of a area of differences of opinion. In the case of, let's say, a 20-meter beam, where each of your elements are in the vicinity of 8 feet long, let me think now, 16 feet for 10 meters, yeah, around 8 feet long. And if you've got your 20-meter beam mounted close to the ground, maybe it's on top of a wooden ladder, and the beam is aimed straight up in the air, and you've got the reflector, let me pick a number, 5 feet off the ground, and you stand on that ladder with the grid dip meter, just to find out, do the elements have resonance? In other words, they're not the telescoping tubing hasn't yet developed a hell of a lot of aluminum oxide and so on. When you're using a grid dip meter to measure the resonant frequency of the individual elements, you're proving that they are working and they're resonating. You cannot use the grid dip meter to measure accuracy. In other words, if you expected the director to measure 14.5 megahertz of resonance, you measure 14.4 or 14.6, does that indicate something's wrong with the director? Absolutely not. This is an extremely rough test to find out, is the director acting like a director? But because of the coupling to the nearby elements, a little bit of that is because your body is nearby, a little bit of that is because the ground is nearby, you're going to get some other effects, but they're not as major as the nearby director and driven element. So the grid dip meter is not an exact measurement. You're not going to get the 2 decimal places of accuracy out of it. You're just going to find it's got resonance. So as long as you know what you're looking for, I mean, the grid dip meter is not going to tell you to make this Yagi work better that that particular element has to be longer or shorter. The
repeater, timeout.
The grid dip meter is not going to tell you that. If you want to find out, is the next step of improvement in the performance of the Yagi going to be to make that particular director you're measuring with the grid dip meter to make it longer or shorter? The grid dip meter is not going to give you that information. There's a very complex action going on inside of the Yagi when it's doing its thing. You want to really tune the Yagi for best forward gain. You have to set it up on some kind of an antenna range where you can measure forward gain. Or if you want to tune it for the best front-to-back ratio, it's got to be on some kind of an antenna range where you can measure front-to-back ratio. That's not easy, but it can be done. So the grid dip meter is a very rough test that that element is operational, but you can't use the exact number you get off the grid dip meter to do anything with it, as long as it's in the right ballpark. If you measure that element and it comes out 28 megacycles of resonance instead of 14, yes, something is wrong. But if it's in the vicinity of 14 megacycles on a 20 element, on a 20 meter beam, the grid dip meter tells you that element is active. So I wonder if some of this makes some sense, Joe. To V2RYY, V2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, well, I was basically speaking about beams maybe on higher frequency, but I realize that on lower frequencies you can get bad joints in the telescopic tubing and so forth, and that's part of the question, like you seem to answer. You're verifying that the elements are indeed working approximately where they should be working. Now, here's another question related to this. If you were going to make yourself up a vertical dipole, something you're going to end feed on a particular frequency, say like you want to make something that worked at 40 meters, maybe it has to have some traps in it or something like that, would you end up showing the frequency at 40 meters, or would you have to go to a multiple of 40 meters to show the correct resonance back to you?
Yeah, there's a complicated question going on here, Joe. You take, for instance, K2 UPS. I visited him over the weekend, where he was at High Point. He was at West Hills Park in Melville, and the particular antenna he uses on 40, 20, 15, and 10 is a piece of wire, 58 feet long, green piece of wire, which one end of it goes to a tree, and the other end of it goes right down to the ground, and the whole thing is slanted at a 45-degree angle. 58-foot length of wire. To be a half wavelength on 40 meters, it should be 66 feet long. It's only 58 feet long. Therefore, it's going to be quite capacitive. It's a little bit shorter than it's supposed to be. However, with his antenna tuner, he can bring that into a good standing wave ratio into his KX3, I think it is, solid-state transceiver that he uses. Let me drop it. So, to measure the resonant frequency of that wire, you'd have to disconnect it from the feed mechanism. You'd have to hold the grid dip meter near the center of the wire, a straight-out piece of wire where you're normally feeding it at one end. The grid dip meter will give you the greatest amount of coupling when you hold the grid dip meter near the center of the wire. In his case, because the wire is 58 feet long instead of 66, instead of measuring 7 megacycles of resonance, he may measure 7.9 megacycles of resonance, if you know what I mean. So the grid dip meter is not going to tell you that it's going to give you a hint that your antenna tuner is going to be living with a whole lot of capacitance and correcting for that capacitance in order to re-resonate that antenna in order to make it radiate. He uses a 9-to-1 balance. When you feed the outer end of a dipole, you're feeding something like 1,500 ohms. By way of his 9-to-1 balance, that brings it down to more like 160 ohms, and therefore it's closer to a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio that his antenna tuner can easily handle. So if you're trying to measure a dipole, which is normally fed in the center, and you want to hold your grid dip meter near it, you'd really have to short out the two halves of the dipole across that center insulator in order to measure the resonance. The grid dip meter may not show you the resonance when the feed line is connected to it, because the other end of that feed line is a certain length long. It's either an open circuit or short circuit. It's connected to a transmitter that's turned on or not turned on. There's all kinds of crazy effects. If you put a short circuit across the center insulator of a dipole that's fed in the center, then your grid dip meter will show you the resonance of that dipole. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
W2HWW with another comment, Dick.
Joe first, and then we'll go over to Howie next. Go ahead, Joe.
And you cannot check it across the transmission line itself. Now, that's also true with a Yagi type of beam of a higher frequency. say one that does not have a gamma match, but simply one side is grounded to the boom, and the other side is simply insulated off the boom, which goes to the center pin of your RF connector. So you'd actually have to short out the RF connector to be able to make sure that both elements or parts of your driven elements are actually, you know, shorted together.
I think I disagree with what you just said, Joe. You said there's a kind of Yagi where it's fed in the center, and the left-hand side of the driven element is grounded to the boom, and the right-hand side goes to the center conductor of the transmission line. A good design wouldn't do it that way, because that left-hand side would be launching a significant amount of current of resonance into that boom of that Yagi, and the length of the boom is going to be part of that resonance. So you can take a driven element that's fed with, say, a T-match or a gamma match. And to a degree, you're right. If I feed it with gamma match and I simultaneously ground the center of the driven element, I'm coming very close to what you just described. And it does work. And we've done that. So I better subtract some of the things I just started saying. Let's see what Howie's got to say on all this. WB2HWW. KQRIW. Good, Howie.
Yeah, I was going to say, Dick, what I used to be able to see many years ago when I was growing up and I was playing with VHF beams, especially high gains, you could look at the pattern. All I had to do was have somebody in the shack pee the transmitter, go up and walk around the antenna or stand a few feet away with a fluorescent light bulb, maybe at 20 or 30 watts. More fluorescent light bulb gear, I have something like 100 watts on 2 meters, like with a Charger 662 or a Quake 4 or one of those types of high-powered radios. You could walk around and actually look at the pattern and look at the front to back, and you aren't going to get any measurements, but you have a visual idea of how the pattern looks. That's some old ham told me that. He said, if you want to check how a dipole works or how your beam works, take a fluorescent tube and walk around. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, WD2HWW.
Hi. Hi, yeah, that fluorescent tube is a nice visualizing device for strong local RF fields. Back in the days when we used HF transmitters that had a real tube in the final with a real tank circuit, a Pi network, for instance, you open up the shielded cage of that transmitter and hold a neon tube or a fluorescent light bulb or whatever nearby, gets very nice effects. And so if you're running a high enough power from your Yagi antenna that you can light up a fluorescent tube, I guess the fluorescent tube in some cases is on the end of a long pole, you're standing on the ground and holding the fluorescent tube up there in front of the Yagi. Unfortunately, unless you're running an awful lot of power, unless by some magic you've got an extremely sensitive fluorescent tube, to be able to truly see the pattern of the Yagi, the main lobe, the side lobe, the front to back, by way of the fluorescent tube, it's kind of difficult. Without a doubt, it'll light up in front, but it may not light up very well in the other positions. So to really measure the rest of the pattern, you're going to have to do something a little bit more to have somebody run a strip chart recorder that's receiving your antenna from, let's say, a block away or a mile away, while you use your antenna rotator to rotate the beam. That's a good way to get a pretty good pattern. If there's a large local reflecting object like a water tower, let me drop this. A water tower in a particular direction. When the beam is aimed toward the water tower, the guy who's doing the remote receiving is going to see another slight peak in that area. He may find a side lobe on one side of your Yagi that doesn't exist on the other side. And you'll know right away that any reasonable Yagi that has a particular side lobe amplitude, they're almost always balanced. If you had to intentionally design a Yagi so that the second side lobe on the right side is very different than the second side lobe on the left side, it would be very difficult to do that. So when you see that effect, you know you're getting some kind of a local environment effect. But when it comes to my 432 Yagi on the top of my 100-foot tower, I did manage to confirm its antenna pattern. Let me drop.
By having John Sandel, WA2FUZ, in Levittown, measure signal strength while I rotated it in Huntington. And I also chose another guy, I forget what it was. By choosing a couple of different guys in different directions, he measures signal strength while you rotate the antenna, while you're running key down, you eventually come up with a whole lot of data that, properly combined, will tell you what the real antenna pattern is. And because each of these guys are in a slightly different azimuth direction from me, what that water tower does is going to have a slightly different position on that rotation of that so-called antenna pattern. So I'll eventually be able to figure out, and by way of a map, I know exactly where the water tower is. I know how many miles away and what direction it is from me. So I was able to measure my, in fact, I did it backwards. By the way, you know when you're measuring an antenna pattern, whether the antenna under test is being used as a transmitter or a receiver, doesn't matter. I had John Sandel aim his Yagi at me and give me a steady signal for the next 5 minutes, key down. Let me drop the key. I looked at the signal strength I got from him out of my Yagi by putting it into a strip chart recorder. So as I rotated my Yagi in the receive mode, on that strip chart recorder was the antenna pattern. So that's how I did it. Anyone have any further questions or comments on how to measure an antenna pattern in the real world, in your real environment? As you can tell, that's one way of doing it. And what I had done, by the way, is to take the automatic gain control voltage out of my receiver through the right kind of an amplifier with gain adjustment. That went into the XY plotter. I took the voltage coming out of the HAM-M rotator as it rotated. That told me what the azimuth was. That went to the X-axis of the XY plotter. And the automatic gain control voltage out of the receiver went to the Y-axis of the XY plotter. That's how I plotted the antenna pattern. Let's see if Joe's got any further questions or comments about all of the above. WA2RYY, the guy who got us on this set of questions. K2RYW and TechNet, you got it, Joe.
Yeah, one more question, final question. When you were working at that company and you were designing a Yagi to work between 902 to 928, you designed the antenna to give you a certain amount of gain and have extremely low return loss across the entire band. Did you also happen to check any of those elements to see where they resonated after you got done with the whole project? Back to you.
No, I didn't, Joe. I had no reason to do that. I knew that a three-element Yagi at 902 megacycles, that's really singing, will have a little bit more than 6 dB over isotropic of gain. I was getting 6.2 dB of forward gain. I didn't care what the front-to-side ratio was, what the front-to-back ratio was. Didn't care about anything else. It had the demonstrated forward gain. I knew that every one of those elements was singing. Their exact resonance is something of only an academic interest. And when I made those elements out of very wide pieces of sheet copper, copper foil, mounted on a piece of mylar, that was the test fixture for designing the Yagi. When I had each element of just the right length, just the right width, just the right shape, just the right tilt, and so on, and the trivet element, which was gamma fed, I had to do a whole lot of tweaking. But when I finished doing all of that tweaking with little pieces of copper foil on the snowflaking technique, as it's called, for doing, I was able to get the standing wave ratio 1.05 to 1 across the whole region of 902 to 928 megs. So I got extremely low standing wave ratio just over that particular active frequency region, and I was getting 6 dB of forward gain. I knew it was singing. I didn't have to make any other measurements. So, they started off in the beginning. Let me drop it. They thought the antenna would be tolerable if it had a standing wave ratio of 1.2 to 1.3 to 1 across 902 to 928. And they sent that requirement out to a whole bunch of antenna companies with a request for bid, request for quote. and half of the companies no quoted. The other half of the companies gave no response at all. And you call those companies on the phone and say, how come you gave no response? And they said, we assume that that crazy specification you gave us came from the purchasing department, not from the engineering department. What you're asking for is impossible. So they were positive it couldn't be done. Of course, that 3% band was 902 to 928 to get that lowest standing wave ratio. And to use the right techniques with the right tuning procedure with a good vector network analyzer, much, much better than that can be done. But you can't buy it anywhere else. It's got to be your own design. So antenna design is a really black art, as you can tell. It's not very well taught in the schools. Unless a person has 10 or 20 years of experience at a good company, he's not going to get the knowledge of how to do it. Let me drop it. And even after a 10 or 20 year apprenticeship, he might still not be able to do it if the particular environment he's in are people who believe that it can't be done and they never even tried to do it. It all got started because I started making the elements wide. I knew that the elements would become more broadband and could be tuned to a lower standing wave ratio if the elements were wide. And I started making the elements wider and wider. There's a pretty weird looking Yagi. I could give you the patent number where you could look it up and you'll see a picture of that Yagi. It's a three element Yagi, and each of the elements, as I said, are about 3/4 of an inch wide when the elements are only 4.5 inches long. That's a ridiculous width to length ratio for elements of a Yagi. Most people believe that the elements of a Yagi should be small in diameter so that they're high in Q, because they believe high Q parasitic element is where the gain is coming from. They believe that. It's not true at all. You may have some further questions on this one, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, I have no other question. I just was kind of curious if you did that. And I guess at the end of the day, you just told everybody, just get out of your way. Watch me show you something.
Well, I didn't have any trouble with the people I was working with or the people in the building. It's the other vendors of antenna products who didn't believe it could be done. And finally, when it did get manufactured in Taiwan, we gave them the exact dimensions as to how to manufacture it, the metal that went inside. And they also were skilled at doing injection molding, so there's kind of a rubber that gets spread over the antenna so that it can be mounted on the front end of this handheld reader, so that now there's no sharp edges of metal that the person using the thing is exposed to, so to speak. And when they were building those antennas, they were testing them for us. And the test that they did in Taiwan was to measure the standing wave ratio over that frequency region and the gain, okay? That company had never seen an antenna that looked like that. They assumed that this three-element Yagi made out of very wide elements would radiate broadside, not infire. In other words, they would mount two of these antennas, let's say 3 feet apart, with both of them aimed at the ceiling. The flat, wide sides of the antennas were aimed at each other. That's the way they thought was the way the signal came out of the antenna. So they would aim the two antennas up at the ceiling and measure the gain. And because it was a metal ceiling in their building, they were getting a reflection off the ceiling. But the apparent gain was some crazy number, like minus 15 dB, instead of plus 6.2. Let me drop. But they were getting beautiful standing wave ratio readings out of their vector network analyzer. I tried to get them to measure the gain the right way. There was this huge language barrier between these people who speak Chinese in Taiwan and us. We never did get that straight, and I ignored their gain measurements. It made them happy to make a gain measurement and tell us what the apparent gain was. I didn't need their gain measurement. When the antenna has the right shape, the laws of physics dictate what antenna pattern it's going to give you. So once they confirmed that, and by the way, if they made any slight change to the shape, the standing wave ratio, when you're asking for a 1.05 to 1 standing wave ratio, 20 some odd dB reflection coefficient minus, when you're asking for that, the shape has to be exact. You make the slightest change of the shape or length of any element, the standing wave ratio would jump up real fast. So if it matched the standing wave ratio requirement, I knew it had the right shape. Once it has the right shape, it's got to have the right antenna pattern and gain. It doesn't have to be confirmed. You don't have to take every brick that you're using to build a building and drop it on the ground to make sure that gravity's going to pull it down. You make a leap of faith that every brick is going to have the right amount of gravity, if you know what I mean. You don't have to make that measurement. In this particular case, if the standing wave ratio over that bandwidth was there, that means the shape was perfect, that means the gain had to be there, and it didn't have to be measured. So I ignored the fact that they couldn't measure gain, and they were building a whole bunch of antennas for us, and we were shipping them, and it worked like a charm. Anyone have any further questions on this before we go over to the next questioner? K2RIW listening. The next person on us was Bill, W2SAW. So, Bill, what would you like to ask us about tonight? K2RIW listening. You got it, Bill.
Good evening, Dick and all. This is Bill, W2SAW. My question tonight was, does a high-Q antenna offer any advantage in a noisy environment?
Okay. The question you've asked has got four or five different questions you could be asking. So I'm going to need a lot more words, Bill. What are you doing to change the Q of the antenna? You're changing the mounting. Are we talking about VHF, UHF? Because you're talking about noise pickup, most likely you're talking about HF. And because you live in New York City, in the heart of New York City, so to speak, there's an awful lot of local man-made electronic noise where you live. And whether or not you can get rid of that noise by way of the tuning or the properties of your antenna is something else. If, for instance, you are using a high-gain Yagi antenna, which had only one main forward lobe, and if most of the time you can aim it in directions away from the source of local noise, in other words, if two blocks away, you've got a shopping building, you've got a supermarket with a great big parking lot with a whole bunch of noisy fluorescent lights or high-pressure or low-pressure sodium lights making a whole lot of noise, as long as you can aim your antenna away from that parking lot, then the noise is not going to bother you very much. But in general, let me drop this. If we're talking about a fairly simple antenna, like a dipole, which has an extremely wide figure 8 pattern, where the forward lobe is around 85 degrees wide, and the back lobe is around 85 degrees wide, at the half power point. So the antenna is receiving signals from almost every direction. And so if in many of those directions there are local electronic noise in Manhattan coming into your antenna, can you change the amount of noise you receive by changing the Q of the antenna? I think the answer is no. Let me show you why. That antenna, if for instance it happens to be 32 feet long as a dipole on 20 meters, and so it can pick up signals at around 14 megacycles. And if those 14 megacycle signals are coming from a ham radio operator, you're happy. If those 14 megacycle signals are coming from local noise generation of man-made objects, you're going to be unhappy. And can you do something to the antenna so that it has the intelligence to be selective, where the antenna says, hey, that 14 megacycle signal is man-made noise, and I'm going to reject it, and this other 14 megacycle signal is a ham radio operator, and I'm going to accept it. Can you teach an antenna to do that? No way. Now, if you happen to be getting a whole lot of local noise that goes across the whole Don spectrum, that overloads the front end of your receiver, and so some of that noise is out of band, but overloading your receiver and therefore showing up in the loudspeaker, so to speak. Let me drop it. And if you had a real sharp front end bandpass tuner that only passed the signals at 14 megacycles and rejected the noise at 7 megacycles and 28 megacycles, so the receiver is not now being overloaded, and that filter has a high Q in the way it does its tilt frequency selection, so that only the desired frequency region comes in, and that narrow band frequency region getting through that filter no longer overloads your receiver, and now it behaves in the right way. So in that way, you're making the apparent Q of the antenna very high by way of a good sharp filter you've added to that antenna network. But this is a classic case, Bill. Lots of people would like to teach a piece of electronics to accept the signal and reject the noise. But if the noise happens to be on the exact same frequency, in general, you can't do that, because what you and I call noise is a subjective judgment, because it's a random thing that you didn't desire. We call it noise. And this other thing from a ham radio transmitter is desirable, and we call it signal. And there's no easy way to teach your electronic circuits and your antenna to accept one and reject the other. There's a lot more to the story, but maybe we're getting a little bit more of the picture here, Bill. W2SAW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I think I understand that you can't, there's no way to separate what is really signal and what is noise. In my apartment, as you probably know, I'm reduced to using loop antennas for HF so that they fit. And I've often read it when poking around that loop antennas are more quiet than, let's say, a dipole. And I thought that that might have been related to the Q, and that because just in general, less garbage was getting through to the receiver, that there might be some advantage there. But I imagine the receiver just throws away all that stuff that's off the frequency, so it doesn't really give you any advantage at all. Back to you.
When I go to QRZ.com and type in W2SAW, I see this nice picture of your multi-turn loop antenna. And by the way, if you take a look at the May issue of QST Magazine, that if you're a subscriber is just arriving this week, and you go to page 55, you'll see a very nice picture of the alpha so-called magnetic loop antenna. And I saw one of those this weekend being used by W2PPI, Mike. He was standing right alongside of Rich K2UPS with his slanting, sloping antenna. And the two of them were using very similar rigs. So loop antennas are a hell of a lot higher in performance than most people will realize. Because the loop antenna is physically small, I'd say, for instance, 40, 20 meters. You assume it's going to have a very small capture area and get very little signal. Not true at all. And because the loop antenna is so small and easy to rotate, you can quite often rotate it so if there's one main direction where noise is coming into your antenna, and you rotate that loop antenna so that you aim the null. It's got a very sharp null, by the way. It's got a figure eight pattern. It's got a very sharp null broadside. In other words, if you make the broadside direction of that loop antenna toward your source of noise, you'll receive, let me drop this. You'll receive the minimum amount of noise. Because the loop antenna is so easy to rotate and you can get rid of noise with it, that's part of the reason why people say a loop antenna can be very quiet. But the loop antenna itself, when it's properly resonated and impedance matched, and if you compare the signal strength you get off the loop at the exact same altitude as a full-size half-wave dipole, the two signals you measure will be almost identical. You're about to ask me, does that mean the effective capture area of that loop antenna is almost the same as the effective capture area as the full half-wave dipole? And the answer is yes. Of course, that's opposite of common sense. And yes, the loop does have much higher Q. In other words, as you QSY, as you tune up or down the band and change your frequency, the standing wave ratio will climb much faster on the loop antenna than it does on the full halfway dipole. Let me drop. So the loop has got a very sharp tuning characteristic. This alpha loop, for instance, has a variable capacitor, and you're going to wish that that variable capacitor had a Vernier knob on it, because it's very sharp in its tuning. But when you get that capacitor tuned to the right way, which is literally tuning the resonant frequency of this loop, then it gives you full performance. And how can something that is roughly 1 meter in diameter, roughly 3 feet in diameter, give the exact same amount of signal being captured compared to an antenna that is 32 feet long as a dipole? How can a 32-foot long dipole give you the same signal strength on receive as a loop that's 3 feet in diameter? Opposite of common sense. That's the magic of resonance. For a whole bunch of reasons you guys have heard me say so often, that if you're designing an antenna, you resonate first, and then it can radiate. By way of the antenna tuner and other things that you use, the thing that you call antenna is going to be resonant at the frequency you're using it at if you want it to do a good job of transmitting or receiving. And that loop gives you a nice high Q resonance. High Q in this case is defined as, what's the bandwidth? You tune 100 kc high or low in the loop, and you're going to definitely want to retune it. Tune 100 kc high or low in the dipole, you may not have to do anything. You may not even have to touch up the antenna tuner. So, making something small makes it sharp in its tuning. It makes it high in Q. But if you've built it out of low-loss materials, it can have almost the exact same performance as that dipole. I know that sounds crazy. Since the average guy uses the loop very close to the ground, and his halfway dipole is 32 feet long, he's probably using it 30 feet in the air. Now, when you have those two different altitudes and you compare signal strengths, yes, you're going to get a weaker signal out of the loop close to the ground. That's not necessarily bad. You're getting a weaker S-meter reading. You may measure something that's a 1 S-unit lower in amplitude out of the loop, but you're also measuring 1 lower S-unit of noise, and the signal-to-noise ratio coming out of the loudspeaker might be the same. W2SAFW, K2RIW, go ahead, Bill.
Thank you, Dick. That's pretty clear. And I guess it's a bit of a myth that the woods is significantly more quiet. But I do have one other quick question, if you have time for it.
Yeah, we have very few people to sign in tonight, so you've got the floor, Bill. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, it's a little weird, but we build our radios, our transmission lines, our antennas to function at 50 ohms. Free space is 377 ohms. So my mind says to me that that must create some kind of standing wave right there. And would there be any advantage to building our systems to all work at 377 ohms? Thank you.
Yeah, that's an easy trap to fall into, Bill. The 377 ohms of free space, is that real? It's real as far as the theory of electromagnetic fields, the fields and waves courses that you take, the Maxwell's equations. From that point of view, it's real. Your transmitting antenna, depending on how you build it, the actual impedance that your transmission line going into the antenna sees could be 1 ohm, 10 ohms, 50 ohms, 100 ohms, 500 ohms, 1,000 ohms. You could make the feed impedance of your antenna any number that you like, depending on how you design the antenna. There's nothing magic about 50 ohms, even though that's our most popular kind of coaxial cable is 50 ohms. Which, by the way, where did that number come from? The best explanation anyone has, let me drop it. Is that 50 ohms was chosen as a compromise between 35 ohms and 72 ohms. If you build coaxial cable with the right inner and outer diameter ratio so that it has a 35 ohm impedance, then for that diameter of coax, it'll handle the highest amount of power. So 35 ohms gives you maximum power. If you then readjust the center conductor to outer diameter ratio so that 72 ohms collects transmission line impedance, you get the lowest loss. So lowest loss is 72 ohms, highest power is 35 ohms, 50 ohms is sort of halfway between the two, it's a compromise. That's one explanation on how we might have settled on 50 ohms. And by the way, an awful lot of the instrumentation used in Europe is set up for 70 ohms. You can buy a vector network analyzer where the front panel connector is made for 70 ohms, for instance, in Europe. Let me drop it. Now, the antenna itself is a standing wave structure. That means the power you put into that dipole, for instance, you'd like to think that the power you put into that dipole travels along the wire of the dipole and jumps into space. Absolutely not. The majority of that energy on each cycle you put into that dipole travels along the wire, comes down to the end of the wire, 5% of it gets radiated, sees the end of the wire, reflects back, another 5% gets radiated. The signal is going to bounce back and forth on that wire roughly 10 times before it finally gets radiated. That's what they mean by a standing wave structure. Radiation is hard. You have to kick that signal in the tail 10 times in a row before it finally goes out there into space. Whether you built the antenna in such a way that it's got a higher Q, which means that instead of the signal bouncing back and forth 10 times, it bounces back and forth 30 times before it gets radiated, it doesn't matter. So the exact impedance of space is not a real factor. As long as your definition of resonance is to make sure that all those bounces stay in phase with each other, stay co-phase, stay in step with each other. That's what resonance means. That all those bounces are on the same phase. That's what you do when you resonate the antenna. And you can resonate it by its physical length or by the tuning network you put on it, like the antenna tuner. Let me drop it. So no matter what the real free space impedance of your antenna is, the signal is going to bounce back and forth on your antenna until it finally gets radiated. In the case of a microwave antenna, which is made in the form of a horn, there are people who think you flare the end of the horn where it gets wider at the mouth compared to the throat of the horn, that you're slowly tapering the signal into a 377 ohms. There are people who have that theory about a horn. Sounds good, but in almost all cases, if you make the horn longer and bigger, you'll get more gain. So, in theory, you could make the horn so big and so long, instead of being 300 ohms at the mouth, it would be 3,000 ohms. It's still going to give you that extra gain, and it's still going to radiate. So, you're not impedance matching to space. You're impedance matching between your standing wave structure called antenna, and the doodads you use in there to give you the correct resonance and impedance match to your transmission line. And no matter what the impedance of free space is, no matter what the impedance of your dipole, your antenna is, if you get everything set up just right, all the power into it that you put into it is going to get radiated. If you built it out of low-loss materials, it can't be wasting it as far as heat is concerned. If you've got a good impedance match, it can't be reflecting any of the signals. So you're putting power into the antenna. If it has a low standing wave ratio, the power goes into the antenna and none of it comes back to you on the transmission line. And if the antenna is made out of low-loss materials, it's not wasting the power. There's nothing left by the law of conservation of energy. It's radiating that energy. So you don't have to impedance match free space. Let me drop. In the case of a great big parabolic dish antenna, like for instance the 240-foot diameter Goldstone dish for the NASA Deep Space Network, man, if that great big dish had to be impedance matched to space, the 370.7 ohms of space, I don't know how you would do it, but I guarantee you it would be difficult, not required. So you could say the 377 ohms of space is a nice theoretical number. It makes the fields and waves equations work correctly. From our point of view, it isn't real. We don't really see it. The signal we put into that antenna, when everything is set up right, it's going to be radiated, no matter what the heck space is. I will admit now, if you make a great big change of the free space, let me drop this. And for instance, you put your antenna underwater, and you're now about to ask, what's the electronic impedance of water compared to air? I don't know what the number is, but it's a much